The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
All right, it's time to come on and feel the noise on Talk is Jericho today with bassist Rudy Sarzo and drummer Frankie Benali from Quiet Riot. They're dropping by to talk about the new Quiet Riot documentary. Well, now you're here, there's no way back. It's an amazing piece of film. It aired on Showtime a couple months ago. And if you missed it or don't get Showtime, the documentary is being released on iTunes and Google Play on August 18th. We'll be reminding you from time to time. You got to go check this out. You got to pick it up. You got to hear the rise and fall and rise again, the story of Quiet Riot. We're going to get into that whole story with Frankie and Rudy today, their heyday, the fallout with singer Kevin Dubrow because of his drug problems and dealing with his untimely death. It affected Frankie's life, his friendships, his career. This is a story of redemption and what it's like for Frankie to get the band back going again. Rudy, no longer in Quiet Riot, but one of the greatest, most respected bass players of all time. Frankie's been in Quiet Riot from the start all the way till now. They're old friends. You can hear it. It's an amazing show today. And plus, to kick it off, back by popular demand, one of my most popular guests, Ash the Fish Expert, one of the smartest kids I know, also happens to be my son. Today he's taking us to the murky waters of the Amazon River and some of the not-so-friendly fish that dwell in there. It's going to be an education in aquatic animals. Ash, of course, has got some survival tips in case you ever find yourself unexpectedly thrown overboard in that river. And if you do, and your luggage ever do wind up in the Amazon, one thing you don't have to worry about is all the money you're losing in racers when your bag sinks to the bottom of the river. That is the greatest segue of all time. At least you won't be losing a fortune if you're a member of the Dollar Shave Club. Yes, those razors can sink to the bottom of the Amazon River. You're not losing anything because Dollar Shave Club will replace your blades and the handle lickety-split. So here's what you need to do. You sign up at dollarshaveclub.com right now. It just takes a couple minutes. It'll save you a ton of cash, and your razors and handle will be delivered right to your front door for just a few bucks a month. It's really that easy. It's really that inexpensive. I use Dollar Shave Club razors today to get rid of my little scruff that I had for the History Channel pilot that I did. I use Dollar Shave Club because they have great quality razors. You can pick your plan. You get monthly delivery if you shave every day like I do, or you get razors delivered every other month if you don't shave as often. If you just got a little teenage mustache, you don't need a lot of shaving attention, you don't need as many razors, and you don't have to pay for as many razors. Dollar Shave Club gives you that option. They also send you the handle and then your replacement blades whenever you want them for just a few bucks, okay? Dollar Shave Club is such a great deal. You can treat yourself to a fresh blade every week. Hell, you can do it every day if you want to. So what are you waiting for? You got to sign up for DollarShaveClub.com. Upgrade to the smarter way to shave. Get your great shave where I get mine. DollarShaveClub.com/Jericho. DollarShaveClub.com/Jericho. Shave time. Shave money. Shave us, Y2J. It's the DollarShaveClub.com/Jericho deal. I want you to go check it out and get the greatest razor and the closest shave you can possibly get. I know I use it. I want you to do the same. Shave it up, baby.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride, because it's Friday.
It's Friday, gotta get down on Friday.
And let's jump straight into the water with one of TIJ's most popular and most frequently requested guests. It's the return of Ash the Fish Expert. All right, it's time for the return of one of the most critically acclaimed guests on Talk is Jericho. He hasn't been on for a while, but he is back today, and we have Ash, the Fish Expert, is here. Ash, it's good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's been a while. You want to keep your fans waiting, right?
Yeah.
So we were watching River Monsters featuring your hero, Jeremy Wade.
Called Amazon Apocalypse.
Okay, well, tell us what happened to Amazon. It was really interesting, so I wanted you to tell us, because I was kind of confused as to what happened.
Because he wasn't paying attention.
Well, that too. But you were going to tell me, in general what happened on this Amazon apocalypse. So fill us in about the whole story.
The whole story begins when 30 years ago, a ship considered to be the safest ship on the Amazon. By the way, this is all credit. This goes to all of this credit goes to Jeremy Wade. This is not copyrighted. Anyway, it all began when 30 years ago, a ship called the Sorbel Santos, filled with 600 plus passengers, sank in the middle of the night, and only a third of the people survived this terrible tragedy. Another third of the bodies were never found and never recovered. And the ones that were horribly grotesque, all eaten, shredded, disgusting limbs.
So this ship sank in the middle of the Amazon River?
Middle, right in front of...
Do we know why it sank?
It was overloaded. There's three main ships, and one was in repairs, one had just busted. So everyone scheduled for those two ships had to go on the Sorbel Santos. And there was a bunch of cargo, too.
So it was just too heavy to overload it.
It was just too heavy.
How big is the Amazon River?
Well, if you take all the other rivers in the world, biggest rivers in the world, and combine them, they would only be a fraction of the Amazon River.
So this is a huge river, almost like
huge,
almost like a lake or something, like an ocean or something like this, or a lake.
On the show, it said it has more species of a fish in the actual Amazon than there is in the actual ocean.
Wow. Okay, so the ship sinks, 200 people survive, 200 people bodies are recovered, and 200 bodies are never recovered. And the ones that are recovered are torn to pieces, eaten up. So is that piranhas that eat them up, or what happened?
Well, there's a number of creatures that are responsible for this tragedy, and one of them happens to be piranhas. Mm-hmm. Who are day scavengers, for all you who don't know. They're scavengers, and they hunt during the day. So, basically, you could get in a tub of piranhas, you know, regular piranhas, just get
like
into
in the
a
bathtub.
Yeah, within a bathtub with, like, a whole school of piranhas, and they wouldn't attack you.
Why?
Unless you were thrashing around, bleeding. They are attracted to movement. Unlike most fish, just moving, splashing, thrashing around, causing a commotion on the surface, will attract lots and lots of piranhas.
So if you just stand still, they'll just swim right past you?
You can sit still. They'll just swim right past you. They'll swim all around you. They won't attack you unless, you know.
Something that's good to know if you ever fall into a pit of piranhas.
Just stay still.
When I used to wrestle in Japan, some of the garbage wrestling companies used to have matches where if you lost, you had to put your head in a tub with a piranha in it.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Did you ever lose?
I was never in one of those matches, nor will I ever be. But now if I was in one and I lost, I would just stay completely still.
Yeah.
Okay. So piranhas were some of the culprits, but what else were we seeing?
Well, like I said, there's scavengers, and then there are the ones that are pulling people down as they're thrashing on the surface. They're pulling people down, and then the other fish can pull them down.
What other fish was pulling them down?
The fish that were pulling them down were mainly two large predatory catfish that have instincts to bolt as soon as they grab onto something. So one of the fish is a paraiba. Say it with me.
Paraiba.
Paraiba. Yeah.
Paraiba.
And they're big catfish. Some people call them river sharks
because
they look lots like sharks. And they are feared like sharks in, you know, lower Amazon Delta areas like that.
Okay.
And what they were doing is they'd grab onto someone's leg or arm or foot. And then once their predatory instincts is to grab, if they grab onto something that's too big or just anything, as soon as they grab onto it, they'll drag it to cover. They'll go to cover. They'll go into reeds or a cave.
So they pull their prey into like this camouflaged areas.
Well, not even prey. They bite. They grab on, you know. And if they can't swallow it whole, then they just keep on. There's
so they're biting chunks of flesh out.
No. They're just grabbing whole legs and then dragging. They have huge heads and huge mouths, so they could fit, you know, up to knees worth of leg.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, obviously that's, you know.
So they're biting your leg up to your knee.
Possibly. And then there's also arms, elbows.
So are they carnivores?
Yes. Oh. Yes, they are.
I wasn't aware that fish were flesh-eating monsters.
Well, it's not that. It's just some can be very vicious. And
okay,
just,
right. So it doesn't matter if it's a person or if it's like a cow walking across the river.
Okay, cow, that'd take a lot of fish.
Okay, so continue.
Anyway, they'd grab onto legs and then just pull down. And then if they wouldn't let go, they'd eventually just tear off chunks, and then they'd let go. By that time, the victim would have been drowned. Mm-hmm. Or they'd grab on, and then they'd let go halfway, and then the other fish would come and then just eat them. And now, like I said, there's the piraíba, and there's also the red-tailed catfish, which is a really heavyweight fish that has, like, its head makes up one-third of its body.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can imagine a big mouth with lots of teeth, but there's actually not a lot of teeth. It's rasping little teeth plates, tiny, tiny little teeth that just grip. They're just gripping teeth.
So they're kind of giving you like a rug burn, like a
kind of like sandpaper. It's like sandpaper, and then they just grab on, and then when you're struggling, they're holding firm, so you're literally just shredding your leg.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know how I was saying they drag them, and then they'd let go, but by that time the victim would be drowned.
Mm-hmm.
Then the scavengers would come in.
Oh. But so the red tail or the
red tail and the piraíba would pull them
dragging
down.
You down.
And then some would let go, some would not let go. And then the ones, you know, if you died in the water, like
if you were drowned,
or even if you were just thrashing around, two other suspects would come to kill you or eat you.
Well, same thing. Go ahead.
And those two are scavenger small fish that you would not suspect to be your killer. But we'll start out with one, and it's a catfish. I can't remember the actual name, but the locals call it the vulture fish because it's a scavenger. And it's a catfish, and it just takes little chunks out with, you know, biting sharper.
Bite-sized chunks.
Yeah, bite-sized chunks. And they are in mass numbers, far more numbers than most other fish in the Amazon. So there's swarms of them.
Hmm.
And those just take little chunks out of you. And then there's another fish that is a scavenger and behaves kind of like the river vulture. That's what it's called, not the vulture fish, river vulture. It's called the candiru azu. Now, if you don't know what that is, and I bet some of you guys don't, no offense, but I bet some of you guys don't know what it is. It is a small, like 6 to 7 inch fish that burrows into you.
Ooh.
So dead people will have sometimes what looks like bullet holes in their legs or chest and arms. But then when they go for the dissectomy, they cut open and then there's nothing left. It's just skin and bone. Because what happens is these candiru azu literally eat you from the inside out.
Oh my
goodness.
Pretty
disgusting tale. And did I already mention how there's cargo? Lots of cargo. Okay.
You said there was lots of cargo on the ship.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of cargo. And some of the reasons why the candiru azu and the river vultures are attacking is because crates are falling on people. And then they'd either be cut up or drowned. They'd get crushed by these falling crates. And then the water would fill up and then drown them. So that's why there's a bunch of scavengers already on the scene. So if you're just a struggling passenger and a fish bites onto you, and then you'll start bleeding, and then more and more will come.
Wow, and then the feeding frenzy starts.
Yes.
Gotcha. Wow, so that's what they figured out, that all of these scavengers and all of these different types of fish, A, helped to kill the passengers, and then B, basically ate their corpses.
Yeah.
So they would disappear.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty gross, man.
It's pretty
those
gruesome.
Ones, can those, which, what are the ones that are burrowing? What are they called? The candiru
azu.
Do they do that to live hosts as well?
What I've learned from the show and just from researching a little bit is that they bite on and you could feel them, so you could pull them off. But if you're like wounded and there's already a little cut hole, they'll just...
There's nothing you can do at that point.
Yeah, if they get a good bite in and they're already halfway in, you got to get to the hospital really quickly.
To pull them out. Oh, it's gross.
Or if you're drunk, you may have... If you're, like, just getting into the water and you just had, I don't know, a couple beers, and they bite on, you might have a little bit of trouble just pulling them off because your brain isn't focused on it. So it'll be like, oh, it's just a little bite, and then 10 minutes later, you're dead.
You've got a fish eating you from the inside out. Yeah. Wow. So the moral of the story is don't go swimming on the Amazon.
Never go swimming on the Amazon.
And if you're going to go on a boat, make sure that it's not oversold.
Oh, yeah.
Overpacked.
Overpacked.
Another... amazing, interesting, educational episode with Ash, the fish expert.
Gruesomely educational.
Absolutely. Well, Ash, thank you, man.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good to be back. Yeah, you want to come back again quicker than the last time?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'll just do a special, like, talk about one separate fish. Maybe you guys could tell me. I don't know.
If you guys got some fish you want Ash to talk about, why don't you go on the Twitter, @TalkIsJericho. Hashtag it, Ask Ash. And what do you want him to ask you, Ash?
What fish you'd like to know? It could be any type of fish. And I'll just, right before the show, I'll look them up. And if I don't know them, I'll look them up and do a little bit of research about them. And then I'll just tell you facts about them, I guess. Or
okay.
Special
right.
accounts of
so
them.
It's @TalkIsJericho. And the hashtag is?
Ask Ash.
All right.
Sorry.
All right, thanks to Ash for joining us, as always, and giving us an education on the flesh-eating catfish of the Amazon River. How does he know this stuff? See what you learn listening to TIJ. I never knew there was such a thing as flesh-eating catfish, did you? If you have a fish request for Ash, who also happens to be my son, just hit him up on the Twitter via this show, @TalkIsJericho, and #AskAsh. You can also follow him on Instagram. He's called... Almost_cool_guy. And when you see the guy with the swank mullet and mustache, yeah, that's my son's profile picture for his Instagram account. He's a character, all right. You know, if you need a laugh to lighten the mood after hearing about the crazy fish creatures that lurk in the murky waters of the Amazon, then you need to go check out my Comedy Central digital series, Nothing to Report. We're almost at 1 million views. We're actually looking just like about 10,000 views, under 1 million, and climbing. And let me tell you this. These are 5-minute bite-sized morsels of comedy genius. It doesn't take a lot of time. You want to go have a cup of coffee and you need something to divert yourself? Get off the Twitter. Get off the Facebook. Go watch Nothing to Report. It takes 5 minutes. You can watch all 6 episodes in half an hour. I'm not asking you for a lot here. People, just go check it out. Go to YouTube. Type in Nothing to Report, and I guarantee you'll love them. Almost 1 million views already. It's just been over 1 month. The more views we get, the more chance that Comedy Central will allow us to make more. Maybe a pilot. Maybe even take us to series. Forget about Key and Peele. Forget about Amy Schumer. Forget about The Daily Show. You're talking about Nothing to Report. Mundy and Jericho. Nick Mundy and I did a press tour over the past week. We're all over the place. We're on Michelle Beadle's podcast, Fox Sports, Sports Nation, Cracked.com. Some hilarious stuff there. We did the Sklar Brothers. We did Jay and Dan's podcast. We did Loveline. That was hilarious. So you're going to get sick of us, but we don't care. We're not going anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. I'm coming at you live. Just finished the pilot for the History Channel. I'm here tonight to do the upfronts here for NBC because I'm hosting Tough Enough. There's another thing that I'm going to be doing. And on top of that, I'm coming back to the WWE for live events only. 19 dates. It's the Y2J WWE Summer Tour. You're only going to see me in these towns: Springfield, Illinois, Terre Haute, Indiana, Las Vegas, Nevada, Boston, Massachusetts, Reading, Pennsylvania, Singapore, July 3rd, Tokyo, Japan, July 4th, Tokyo, Japan, with the first ever meeting of Finn Balor versus Chris Jericho. It's a Japanese fan's dream match. It's a hardcore wrestling fan's dream match. You're going to, if you want to see it, you got to go to Ryogoku in the sumo hall to see this match. It's a one-time only thing. I put it together because I wanted to do it for all the great fans of Japan. I had so many great tours there. I've been there 60 times plus. And for the hardcore fans, it's creating a buzz of Balor versus Jericho, something that no one has ever seen before. And that's one of the reasons why I came back, actually, because I saw the Japanese tour and I said, I either want to work with Finn Balor, I want to work with Hideo Itami, or maybe both. Itami's hurt, Balor's going to be there. We're going to tear the damn house down. So if you want to see something that you don't see every day, be there. You can tell your kids about it. You can tell your parents about it. Hopefully it turns out to be as big and as huge of a match as I think it will. I did it for you guys. I did it for the fans. I did it for Jerichoholics. I did it for Finn's fans. So, you know, I still love you. That's why I'm coming back, because I still love to perform in front of all you people, especially the special match for all the great, great fans in Tokyo who I grew up in front of. Started going there in 1991 and been going there regularly ever since. Speaking of regular, Philly, Pittsburgh, San Diego, Ontario, California, Fresno, Detroit, East Lansing, Bridgeport, White Plains, San Juan, Puerto Rico, Tallahassee. If you have any interest in seeing me this summer, you got to catch me at those cities only. I will be going nowhere else. There will be no TVs or pay-per-views. Only this cool, cool, cool live event. Chris Jericho's Y2J WWE Summer Tour. All right. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. I got Rudy Sarzo and Frankie Benelli of Quiet Riot here. We're going to talk about the new documentary. Well, now you're here. There's no way back. It's an amazing piece of filmmaking. Aired on Showtime earlier this year, and now it's available at iTunes, Google Play, Video On Demand starting August 18th. If you're in the L.A. area, May 22nd, they'll be airing the movie, showing it in Hollywood at the Arena Theater. You can check out all that information at Quiet Riot on that Twitter. We're going to hear what it's like to be in one of the biggest rock bands in the world one day, and then no longer having a band just a few years later. People forget how huge Quiet Riot was, and we're going to jog your memory about how big the band really was in 1983, 1984. We'll also hear about how they dealt with late singer Kevin Dubrow's trouble with drugs and his eventual death because of them, and what it's like to keep Quiet Riot rocking today. All right, and speaking of rocking, I got some rockin' undies on, red, black, rock and roll, stripe me undies for the occasion. These are the undies that don't ride up on you. They move with you. They make you look cool. They keep you rockin'. They keep you cool. They do the wicking property that keeps you comfortable, pulls the moisture away from your skin. These are pre-shrunk undies that you don't get any unwelcome surprises in the wash. Like, hey, these no longer fit me. The banana hammock that cuts off the circulation, you don't need that happening down there. Me undies also look as great as they feel. Sexy beast skivvies, people! And MeUndies make more than just super comfy underwear. They also make the softest, most comfortable socks, hoodies, t-shirts. You name it, they got it. You can see all their fruit styles at MeUndies.com. Your skin is gonna love you. MeUndies products really are that soft. And while you're there, check out the styles for the ladies. Sexy and comfortable as well. Your girl will dig a pair of MeUndies. The chances of the hibbity-dibbity are off the charts when you're wearing MeUndies. So I want you to go check out all the styles. Check out all the maximum sexosity. MeUndies.com/Jericho. You're going to get 20% off your first order and free shipping. And you can save even more when you buy a whole pack of them. They'll be some of the best money you've ever spent. MeUndies.com/Jericho. They come with a money-back guarantee. You got nothing to lose, everything to gain. Once again, go to MeUndies.com/Jericho now. You get 20% off your order and free shipping. You want to look cool, you want to feel good, you want to feel sexy, MeUndies is the way to go, and I'm going to take you there.
What's up, everyone? This is Callan Quinn from Sleeping with Sirens, and I'm turning things up as I bring you my new podcast, We Like It Loud, every Tuesday on podcast1.com. I've got exclusive interviews with the hottest bands on the scene, and I'm also going to be connecting you, the fans, as I answer Twitter questions and give you exclusive access to the music industry like no one else. So download We Like It Loud with me, Callan Quinn, every Tuesday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer. Talk is Jericho.
We're here talking with Frankie Benali and Rudy Sarzo. We're talking about the documentary, Now You're Here, There's No Way Back. But you were just mentioning that your dog now is famous because it was in the documentary.
Yeah. Well, actually, she calls this a dog-cumentary.
Yeah, I hear Duran Duran are going to have a comeback hit with Tori.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Come back here with Tori.
That's right. Your dog's name was Tori?
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Tori on film, I believe, is the Tori tentative title. Film. Yes, for the
there
single.
You go. The documentary. It's an amazing piece of work, and it's great to have you guys here. The rhythm section from the, I guess you'd say, the biggest years of Quiet Riot's career. For so many different ways, and such a great movie. I mean, it's been on Showtime. It debuted a couple months ago, and it's about the life and times, the trials and tribulations of Quiet Riot, which you guys, you were basically there, Rudy, from the start. Frankie, you were there almost from the start, and you've kept this going your whole career, whereas Rudy's kind of gone back and forth here and there. And what's the reaction been so far from the film since it played on Showtime?
It's pretty amazing. I didn't really know what to expect because when you have a 30-plus year history of a band and you're trying to hit all the key points within, you know, a two-hour film, you know, you wonder how many people you're going to be able to please, you know, because everybody wants a certain amount of content. But I've been very surprised across the board. The acceptance and support of the film has been phenomenal. Everybody has learned a lot about the band that they didn't know anything about. You know, a lot of the history of the band, the different components of it, and everything up through real time and the trials and tribulations of being in a band. Because being in a band is you know, everybody thinks you wake up in the morning, the hair's perfect, you already got your rock clothes on, and you go out and you do a gig and everything is fine. You go to a big party and if that happens, you're really fortunate, but when it happens, that's a very small part of it.
People don't really realize the business side of what being in a rock and roll band is. I mean, there's so much of that, especially when you're first starting out, because you just want to rock, I just want to be in a band, I just want to make it happen. You realize pretty quickly there's a whole other side to it, where the musicianship and the songwriting, unfortunately, is basically just the tip of the iceberg to having a successful band.
Yeah, you start out as a group of people who have the same goals and same dreams and hopes in mind, and then when you actually have the opportunity to do that, all of a sudden you all these walls get put up, because now all of a sudden you have to think about all these things you never thought about before, and it affects how you do business. It affects your personal relationships within the band, and the minute success is right around the corner, you're ready to walk through that door. Once you go through that door, everything changes, and you're not prepared for that. Mm-hmm. There's no rule book, there's no blueprint that says, okay, when you do this, then the next thing is that. Right. Nobody has any idea. You learn as you go along, and you make mistakes as you go along.
Has there been a lot of feedback, like, you know, from on Twitter and from the fans after the movie came out, especially for you, Rudy, because it's been such a long time since you were involved with Quiet Riot, especially from that peak of the band's success?
Well, actually, since you, Frankie, you control, you know, the pages and the Twitter, I mean, you will be getting most of the feedback.
The Twitter account has just exploded, and it happens every single time that Showtime airs it. You know, they did the original premiere, but they've kept adding more and more and more showings, and every time it shows, Twitter blows up, Facebook blows up, the Quiet Riot page blows up, the Quiet Riot movie page blows up. So the response has been ridiculous, almost impossible to keep up with. We're getting tweets from really unlikely sources that absolutely love the film.
You know, it's interesting too, like, we're musicians, and I'm a fan, and true fans know what Rudy's been doing, how many bands you've played, and true fans know that Frank has been doing Quiet Riot for the last 30 years. But a lot of fans, I'm sure, didn't. They remember, I had Mental Health when I was, you know, 10 years old or 15 years old. I didn't know anything about this kind of last 25 years of the band's existence. And that's why the movie works so well. Is there such a heartfelt story behind this whole thing? And obviously the partnership between you and Kevin Dubrow, the singer of Quiet Riot, and how what really got me, like, even knowing the story and you know, Kevin's passing in
2007 November.
I thought it was really interesting and really kind of hit home when you said, you know, we made this deal that we'd be doing this when we were 80 years old, and he'd have the walker with the white and black, you know, tape around it.
And it's all true. We would have, you know, the thing about my relationship with Kevin, his relationship with mine, is that we went from being really close to being so incredibly far apart, because of some of the things that happened between us in the band, to becoming really, really close again. So we ended up having lunch and dinner out on the road together every single time we were out on the road, not because we had to, but because we wanted to, because it was usually just he and I, not anybody else in the band. And we would talk about these things. You know, we figured, okay, well, as long as the Super Bowl continues to play, you know, Come On, Feel the Noise or Mental right. Health, or as long as some commercial picks it up, or as long as it's in some film, we're going to have the opportunity to do this well beyond we lose our sight and we lose our teeth, you know, but as long as we can put out the goofy clothes and get up on stage, and that was the plan, that we were going to continue doing that. And it didn't work out that way. The thing for me that's really rewarding about the film is the way Regina Russell, the director, edited everything and put everything together. The greatest part about it is that not only does it appeal to Quiet Riot fans or music fans in general, but it appeals to people who don't really care about music, or don't really care about the right. style of music, or don't really care about Quiet Riot. So they become invested in the story above and beyond that band that had the number one album.
Well, and that's the secret to a great documentary. Regina, you can come on up to the mic. This mic works, right, Stacey? Doesn't work. Okay, we'll figure it out. You and Rudy can do the Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Sharon Mike for a second. What I was going to say is that
Ringo.
the secret to a good documentary is the story. It doesn't matter, like you said, if it's about Quiet Riot, if it's about U2, if it's about Hank Williams, it's the storyline that counts. I mean, there's a great documentary a few years ago called The King of Kong, which was about video games. But it wasn't just about video games and like the best Donkey Kong players. It was about the storyline within it. And that's what why the Quiet Riot movie works. Reminded me a little bit, on a much larger scale, did you guys see the Anvil movie
yes.
a couple years ago?
Yes.
Same idea. Two guys that got together when they were kids that just want to rock, and here they are, you know, 35 years later with nothing, still holding on to the dream. And it was such a heartwarming story, and that's where this came up with too, because Quiet Riot, you forget how big Quiet Riot was in 1983. You really did.
I forgot how big Quiet Riot was in 1983 until we started going through the footage, because, you know, you kind of, that happened so long ago, and even looking back, and I remember pretty much everything, but it was still really surreal. So going back and looking at it was, oh wow, yeah, we were all that, and then some. You know? So yeah.
Talk about the Mental Health record, just the charts. I remember you seen that documentary. The bands that you beat to continue, because it wasn't like it is now. Nowadays, you put out a record, it charts, it goes to number 22. Next week, it's off the charts.
It disappears, yeah.
In those days, it would start at 200 and start working its way up the ladder, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting when I watch the Grammys and I see like all these posers now, you know, the current yeah. you know, big people. And I look at them and say, you know what? We sold more records than these guys. And look at right. them. We never had that attitude, you know, of like, you know, going up on stage and taking away, you know,
the
awards
West
from
thing.
Other people. So like, wait a minute.
You would never do that.
No,
and let exactly. me tell you what. If Kanye West, with all the money that he has, can invent the time machine and he go back to 1983, he would not be able to take our number one record. I don't care. I'll take him down. I'll take him down to the mat. He would not be able to do that, okay? And we're not going to give it to Beyonce either in the past.
So where did Mental Health enter the charts? Do you remember?
I think it broke the top 200. I think it was 184 is when it broke the top 200. You know, a lot of people don't realize. They just think that Quiet Riot put out the Mental Health record and all of a sudden it was number one.
Mm-hmm.
We were out on the road for about 7 months before it really hit the impact. And we were opening up for everybody. Scorpions, Black Sabbath, ZZ Top. I mean, it just, you know, Iron Maiden, it ran the gamut. But it took a lot of work to get it there. And when we got close to the top, all of a sudden, you know, we're looking at this wall of Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie and Paul McCartney and all these.
The Police Synchronicity.
The Police Synchronicity. I mean, all of these established acts that had consistent number one records and like hit singles left and right. And when we got up to that level, we said, what happens now? And it came as a great surprise to us. We were playing Rockford, Illinois, opening up for Black Sabbath, and that's when we found out. You get the numbers a week ahead of time. That's when we found out that next week we had knocked the Police out of the number one spot, and it was surreal, unbelievable. And then we put on our stage clothes and did our set. Opening up for Black Sabbath. Yeah,
how was that for you, Rudy? Do you remember that day?
Oh yeah, I'll never forget, because right after the show, we went over to Rick Nielsen's house
from
and he was preparing for a marathon.
Yeah.
And
he came. let me interrupt for a second. He actually called production and wanted to be put on the guest list because his kids were fans of Choir Riot.
Okay,
so that's how it started. All right.
So we went back to his house and we partied with him, and he fell off.
we partied at Rick's house hard.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
really. Really hard. Yeah. And the last thing we saw was Rick was standing at the top of the stairs outside the house, front door, and his wife is giving us a ride back to the hotel because we had like 8 a.m. Lobby call to go to the next city. And the last thing, we look back, and the last thing is Rick is waving. And then we come to find out that right after we turned that corner and he was out of sight, he slipped, fell, broke his leg, and they were supposed to go out on tour the next day.
Yeah.
So you party with Choir Riot, you party with the best.
Break your leg. Down, down.
Make a note of that.
Make that. Yeah, use that later. Now, Regina, I think now we finally have you up. How did you get involved? Was this documentary something that you had the idea for? Was it Frankie's idea? What's the genesis of this?
Yeah, it was my idea. When he told me he wanted to meet with Kevin's mom and get her permission to go on with the band and find a new singer, I jokingly said, that sounds like the plot of some documentary that you would see. Mm. And then I said, wait a second, I've always wanted to make a documentary. Why don't we make a documentary out of this? And he said, no.
You said no.
Yeah, it's Sicilians. We don't like to put anything out there.
You know? Yeah. So. Yeah, you don't want to open yourself up to that. I'm a rock guy. I'm a rocker.
Yeah, you have your espresso and smoke at the Noboli, and you you call it a day.
How hard was it, I guess interesting was it to go back through and find all these clips? Did you have all this stuff in your house? Did you have to go look for it from super collector fans?
Well, he has a huge archive, and I had actually seen a lot of it because he had shown me all these home movies, and we were sitting around watching them and laughing. And that was another reason what triggered in my mind when I thought of the documentary, and I thought, oh yeah, and then there's all those home movies. But I did have to look through some archives, some film libraries to get some of it.
Mm-hmm.
So because what happens is, you know, we did, when a band like Choir Riot becomes so big, we did a ridiculous amount of interviews. And when you do those interviews, you don't own them. You know, you do the interviews, you put it all out there, you ask the questions, and then all of a sudden, when you need to use it, they're in libraries, and you know, Regina had the daunting task of tracking the stuff down, tracking the people down, and it wasn't just in the U.S., it was overseas, and being able to get the pieces that she needed, you know, to look at and choose what, and then move forward from there. So it was a lot of hard work for her.
Because it's been going on for a while. I remember hearing about this a few years ago.
4 years.
4 years ago?
Four years, yeah.
So it takes a while to get all the clearances and get everything worked out and get all the interviews that you wanted to get. But once it was released, Rudy and I talked about this briefly. How was it for you watching the documentary?
It was very, very emotional, you know, because, you know, it just, with every great story, there has to be conflicts in there, you know. So actually to be reliving, you know, some of the conflicts that happened, there were some great times too, and of course, you know, I cherish those. But just, you know, the certain conflicts, you know, they always, you know, they're a little bit hard to watch. But then again, it makes for a great story. You know, it makes it for a universal story because, I mean, there's going to be bands out there watching the documentary, connecting with it, and saying, you know what, we're going through the same thing. Maybe we can learn from these guys. Maybe we can avoid, you know, whatever decisions that were each certain individual made in the band. You know, maybe we can, you know, learn from this and make better decisions.
Yeah, and I and I share Rudy's feelings, because what happens in a situation is that human nature allows you to continue moving forward by remembering the happy moments and sort of like putting aside the uncomfortable moments, you know, so that you can just continue and be a productive and happy person. And watching, and especially watching the final product when Regina was done with it, for me it was difficult too, for on a couple of levels, because I understood how big Choir Riot was, but I had forgotten how big Choir Riot was. There's a difference between understanding, okay, yeah, we had number one record and we did all this and we did all these tours. There's another thing looking at you know, the US Festival footage and the stuff, the touring stuff and the things on the road. And then also that brings back all of the things that also went wrong with the picture. For as many things as were right with it, there were at least equally as many things that were wrong with it. And all of a sudden you start remembering, you know, all those emotions started coming up again. And it's a difficult thing to process. It is.
Yeah. It's kind of like that scene in Clockwork Orange where at the end he's like watching all his
the forks in his eyes, yeah, blackout by the scorpions.
But instead of like Beethoven, is bang your head.
let's talk about this. I mean, we mentioned, I mean, number one record and the US Festival. I want to talk about that too. I watched that. Actually, now it's on YouTube, the entire set. Mm-hmm. I watched that once a month. It's a great set. It's one of my favorite sets maybe that I've seen in a while. You guys were right on it. You guys were at the precipice. You knew something big was happening.
Yeah.
And well, tell us about that day. Tell us about the US Festival. What do you remember about that? Because there was, well, what, 300,000 people, 400,000 people?
Over 375,000 people, wow, by the time we went on at 11:30. But yeah, you have to understand, you know, the whole road warrior mentality that we had. We had played El Paso, an afternoon show the day before. And it was a dust bowl and hot, and we were covered in sweat, muddy sweat. And we literally had to get off the stage, get in the cars, go to the airport, change in the bathroom at the airport, and fly to Los Angeles.
Was it San Bernardino? Or?
Yeah, San Bernardino. Okay.
Fly to L.A. and drive to San Bernardino.
Yeah, and so, you know, everybody went to their rooms, and the next morning, we had, at 10:30 in the morning, we had to be at the press island. And you know, we're tired and burnt out, and we've got our goofy clothes on. But we had the option of either playing first or having Motley Crue play first and us second. And I had the conversation with Kevin and subsequently with our manager at the time, Warren Etner, that Kevin wanted to go on second. He didn't want to go on first. That was, you know, Kevin's mentality is, you know, he's not an opening act. But the reasoning was that those people were there all night.
Right.
By 11:30 in the morning, it was incredibly hot. They hadn't had any music except what was being canned through the speakers. And the first band that got up on that stage was going to make an impact, especially if we didn't blow it. And 11:30 in the morning, we didn't blow it. We knocked it out of the park.
Is that what time it was? 11:30?
11:30 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah, 11:30
sharp. That crowd was, they were all there. They were ready.
Yeah.
And sometimes you play a festival and 11:30, there's, you know, a few people, but it was...
Well, we were fortunate that at that point in time, radio was already doing a good amount of promotion for the single, for Come On, Feel the Noise. Mm-hmm. So they were aware of the song. When Kevin announced the song, they knew it. And when he announced Mental Health, they knew it. So we had that advantage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we brought it. I mean, we went out there and we did what we were supposed to do. And it was wonderful.
Especially in front of that gigantic crowd. I mean, you're going to see 10 rows of people and then just a moving, breathing entity beyond that.
There was no horizon. There were just heads and hands. There
it was
no,
like, horizon. I looked out in the audience, 375,000 people, and all I could think was, where are they going to go to the bathroom?
The caring, sharing heart of Rudy Sarzo. Right.
Well, you know, always at the forefront of his mind are the fans.
Yeah, of course. You know,
because usually, in an English festival, you get pelted with bottles of whatever, you know.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, bodily fluids.
Well, I mean, they get thrown out the stage, where, you know, and then you try to avoid it.
Exactly. But speaking of which, and this is something I read about in your book, but it's an interesting story. You guys had a really big stage. Kevin's run around a bit. But you have your Rudy Sarzo area, and you're going nuts. You're playing all the different ways. You play bass upside down, but you never moved out of that like kind of a 4 foot space.
That was in Ozzy. That was not in Quiet Riot.
Well, that that was with Ozzy. But you know, at the very beginning, I was still
you had just made the transition.
Yeah,
right?
Making the transition, and you know, and I don't even.
Why was that a rule with Ozzy?
No, it was kind of like something that it changed eventually, you know, because you have to consider this was basically our maybe less than 20th gig that we did as a band, maybe like because we did about three, we did two nights, two shows at the Roxy when we first – that was like the record was released on March whatever.
It was released on March 11th, and the gigs at the Roxy were the 17th and the 18th.
Yeah, okay.
So a week later.
And then we went on to do three shows with Vandenberg up in the – you know, all the Keystones up there.
Northern California.
And then that – maybe we did a show in San Diego at the – what was that called? That small club in San Diego.
No, I don't think. I think after
was that afterwards? Because we
that was afterwards.
We had the RV.
Yeah, that was afterwards. Because we came back after those three shows, and then there was kind of a pause because the band hadn't taken off yet, and it wasn't until we did a gig. Excuse me, we did a gig which was the epitome of Spinal Tap, because in the Spinal Tap film they do a gig at an amusement park, right? Well, that amusement park that they filmed. That's Magic Mountain.
Oh, okay,
and that was the last California show we did before we went off to Arizona and we started the Metal Health tour. Yeah. So it was a lull in the action. Lull. And people don't understand that we did the first video we did was not Come On Feel the Noise. It was Metal Health, and it fell on deaf ears and eyes. You know, I mean, you know,
nobody cared.
Stevie Wonder didn't see it. Helen Keller didn't hear it. You know, I mean, it just went away. And then we did the second one for Come On Feel the Noise. And when that became a rotation hit on MTV, that brought the Metal Health back
up again.
Yeah,
but what I was saying was, were you told when you were in Ozzy, Rudy, that you couldn't move around much on stage, right?
Yeah, well, that was because it was tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened was that I had been playing with Quiet Riot on the Sunset Strip, you know, the Strip and Starwood and stuff like that, and our performance was a little bit more animated than the traditional metal band, which like Black Sabbath.
So the front man commands the stage.
Yeah, exactly, and everybody is basically static as far as, you know, like Geezer and Tony was standing on one side, and Ozzy would do his thing, you know. So she wanted pretty much the same thing. Whereas Randy and I, we came from a more animated presentation.
Because you and Randy started in Quiet Riot, because you were in Quiet Riot before you went to Ozzy. Then you were in Quiet Riot after Randy's passing and you left Ozzy. So were you in the band too at this time? Were you ever in the band with Randy Rhoads, Frankie?
No. And if we go a little bit further back, you got to remember that we recorded the Metal Health record with Rudy in 1982, but Rudy and I met and started playing together in 1972.
Wow.
So 10 years. So we had history before that.
Yeah. Wow.
And when Rudy was already playing in Quiet Riot at the Sunset Strip, he'd always put me on the guest list because I didn't have any money.
Uh-huh.
And I used to love to go see the band because I thought the band was great and I thought Randy was phenomenal and Kevin was very animated, you know, and he came from that British singer kind of school mentality, so it was great. And at one point, they were thinking of changing drummers. And as much as I loved seeing the band, that's not the type of band I wanted to be in at the time, because to me they were a power pop band, and I wanted to be in Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
so it never really happened. Although Randy recommended me to Kevin, as Rudy had recommended me to Kevin, and Randy had also recommended me to Ozzy, and we actually did some rehearsals together.
Really?
Yeah.
Because when Randy got the gig with Ozzy, he kind of brought you along, right, Rudy?
Well, later on.
Later on,
but first. Originally, what happened was that Sharon gave Ozzy the option to only take one guy from L.A.
Why is
back
that?
Back to England. Budgetary.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so he picked Randy, you know. And for the longest time, they didn't have a drummer. You know, they had like a guy who was just sitting in, like a local pub guy and stuff like that. And again, it was a matter of budget, you know. So eventually they got Lee, you know, to be in the band. Again, going back to Quiet Riot, to me, I because I again, Frankie mentioned it was more of a power pop band, and then later on became, and I got to give Frankie a lot of credit for this, it became more of a powerhouse type band, more Led Zeppelin meets AC/DC type of sound because of his playing, you know, Frankie's playing.
Sure.
You know? So it was a whole different direction in the band, you know.
But it also worked because Rudy and I, we're such a strong rhythm section unto ourselves, you know, just organically. I know that when I play something, he knows what it's going to be even before I play it, and the same thing. So what happens in a situation like that is it's very comfortable. We don't have to overthink it. We don't have to worry about it. You know, we're very professional about what we do, but it's a very comfortable thing. And so that created the foundation of what became the Quiet Riot sound.
I always give credit, you know, when people ask me about, you know, my upbringing as a musician. You know, Frankie was the first drummer that I actually played with who had a concept of a rhythm section. The guys before him, you know, we were just playing parts. He played his parts, I played my part, and maybe sometimes we would lock in. And playing with Frankie, he showed me the significance of the bass and drums locking in, and that's something that I've carried with me through since 1972.
Like you said, the classic rhythm section.
Yeah,
but it happened. But it happened also because Rudy was listening to all the right players. You know, I mean, you know,
because Frankie had the biggest record collection I've ever seen in my life.
But you know, every musician is the sum of those influences, and Rudy and I had a lot of the same influences, and they were not like just some static influence. You know, I mean, we loved R&B, but we also loved the progressive bands, and we loved, you know, Free and Led Zeppelin and all that. So it wasn't just some static thing. And it's very difficult to find somebody else that's on the same wavelength as you are. And if it happens to be a bass player and you happen to be a drummer, that's a gift that you don't overlook those things.
Frankie used to work at a record store because, you know, to create a massive collection of records, and, you know, this is not today. You can go on YouTube and listen to anybody you want. Back then, you have to like be able to buy it.
You had to find it.
You have to find it and buy it. Yeah. Frankie used to work at a record store. I think you worked there so you could have access to all those records.
I got all the problems. Well, my record collection started when I was a kid because the first two records that my father gave me was a Miles Davis record and a Max Roach record, followed by a Buddy Rich record. So my collection started, you know, way back then. But working at the record store, sure, because that's when you used to get promos from record labels, and I would get the promos. And then I had a subscription to Melody Maker, the UK newspaper, so I could find out who the new bands were coming out over in the UK. So then I would order those through the record store, and it just went that way. So, you know, Rudy and I had access to, you know, if we wanted to go in a certain direction, you know, we just...
Rudy mentioned your Zeppelin influence and the Bonham influence, and there's that classic feel at the beginning of Metal Health. And I did a thing with, I'm sure you guys have done it before, Sin City Sinners in Vegas, the cover band. And for whatever reason, me and Vinnie Paul were there. I said, let's go do Metal Health. And Vinnie said, okay, how does that feel go? And he had to think about it for a second. Once he got that feel down, he didn't have to do anything else. I got the feel. I got it. Let's do it. And it was great. But just that, you know?
It's very simple. It's a wake-up call. It says, you know, you listen to this because something is about to happen.
Yeah.
That's all it was, just a wake-up
call. Let's talk about the dynamic frontman qualities of Kevin Dubrow. I mean, he was a charismatic guy on stage, great singer, knew how to put on a show. I want to get into that, but first, let me tell you about the guy who's keeping me on top of my performance game, both in the ring and on stage with Fozzy. I'm talking about, you know who I'm talking about, Diamond Dallas Page. I can't say enough about his DDP yoga program. As a matter of fact, Rudy Sarzo is doing this yoga program as well. It's why I'm doing 19 more live events this summer for the WWE, why I'm doing Fozzy dates this spring, this summer, and why I'm in the best shape of my life. I feel better now than I did 10 years ago. I know a lot of you have given DDP yoga a try and are loving it. I want you to hit me up on the Twitter all the time and tell me about it, at Talk is Jericho. Keep the DDP yoga feedback coming. I'll retweet it if it's something cool. Those of you who are thinking about giving it a try, I can't encourage you enough. Just do it. Stop making excuses. Get off your ass and do it. You'll be so glad you did. I'm going to keep saying it for as long as it takes to make sure everyone understands how much DDP yoga has influenced my life and improved my quality of life. It's a great fitness program for everybody. Age doesn't matter. Fitness level doesn't matter. Athletic ability doesn't matter. DDP has workouts for all levels, beginner, intermediate, experts. It takes you through the challenging level workouts. once you figure out what you're doing, the program grows with you. And listen, because you listen to this show, DDP's hooking you up with a great deal in the Max Pack, 15 workouts, nutrition guide, poster help you, to help you remember the 12 core positions of yoga. You'll get the workouts in MP3. You get everything. It's a one-stop shop when you check out ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You take advantage of this special offer, only available to you guys, the Sexy Beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. I want you to take advantage of it now. Get in the best shape of your life and let DDP Yoga and Chris Jericho take you there. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and do it right now. I'm sitting here with current Quiet Riot drummer Frankie Benali and former bass player Rudy Sarzo. We're talking all about the amazing, riveting new Quiet Riot documentary. Well, now you're here. There's no way back. It's available on iTunes, Google Play, and Video On Demand August 18th. If you're in Hollywood, you can go check it out May 22nd at the Arena Theater. We're going to talk upcoming about Quiet Riot's original singer. Their only singer, if you're talking about the history of the band. Their biggest influence, Kevin Dubrow. He had a lot of issues, as talented as he was, and we're talk about the band's struggle to keep going after Kevin's passing, how it affected Frankie so deeply. So much emotional information and stories and issues to talk about coming up. But right now, I got to tell you about TrueCar and why you should download the TrueCar app immediately, okay? You need to download this app so that you don't waste valuable weekend time going from dealership to dealership in search of the perfect car for you. It's so easy. It's so easy. Ooh, it's so easy. It's so easy. I have no idea what the key is of that song. I don't care. It's so easy with TrueCar and the TrueCar mobile app, because in 5 minutes, you not only build the car you want, but you find out what other people paid for it. And then with TrueCar, you lock in the guaranteed savings, which is usually over $3,000 off of MSRP. That's a lot of extra money. Imagine what you can do with that $3,000 in savings. Listen, imagine what you can do with the extra time that you can spend at home, at concerts, at the barbecue, in the pool, whatever it is you like to do, you can just go do it. You don't have to give it up to hunt for a car, right? TrueCar and the TrueCar mobile app can do the hard work for you. I know how much we all need our cars. How are you going to get to school? How are you going to get to the theater to see the Quiet Riot movie? How are you going to get to the bookstore to buy Duff McKagan's book? There's a lot of things you got going on. I want you to get your weekends back. I want you to get the car you want without overpaying. You save time, you save money, and you never overpay. You download the TrueCar app today and get the car you want as quick as you can.
Let's talk about the dynamic frontman qualities and sing qualities of Kevin Dubrow. You know, and that's kind of the crux of the movie of Now You're Here, There's No Way Back. And it was kind of what made Quiet Riot special. And I want to ask you later in a couple of minutes if it was one of the reasons why Quiet Riot kind of had its fall. So let's talk about Kevin first. How was he as a singer, as a frontman?
Well, you know, Kevin was always bigger than life, not just on stage. Just, you know, he'd walk into a room and he would literally suck the oxygen out of the room because he was so dynamic. I mean, you know, Kevin wanted everything out of life and he got it, you know, both good and bad. He was the complete package. You know, he was animated. If you're a singer, you have to have a certain amount of ego, because you have to go out there, you know, essentially bare naked, no guitar, no drums, nothing, and sell it. And he had an incredible amount of self-confidence. I always tell people about Kevin, because there's the duality of it, and I always tell people that Kevin was my biggest asset and my biggest liability, because with everything that he did over the top, it was both over the top good and over the top bad. But I think once you see the movie, you will understand not only the personality and the individual that Kevin was, and how dynamic, but also how troubled he was. But you'll also see how difficult it is for those shoes to be filled.
Sure.
Because he was the complete package. I've told people so many times that Kevin had only two bad shows in his entire career. You know, people have great shows and good shows, but bad ones. He only had two in his entire career. One because he had an incredibly bad cold, and the other one because he had been partying for 2 days solid.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, and when he got up on stage, that was his happy place.
Mm.
That was where he loved to be most. But because he loved it so much, when the curtain came down, he couldn't turn it off.
Right, he became that character.
Yeah, and that's when those problems would surface. And with success came a situation where Kevin just basically did whatever he wanted to do, and nobody could call him on it, because as long as the band was successful, they didn't want to rock Kevin's boat. Mm-hmm. And that just escalated and escalated and escalated until finally, you know, we had no choice. But in 1987, the label, management, the American agent, the European agent, everybody across the board wanted Kevin out because he had become that liability.
Yeah. Rudy, you've played with some amazing frontmen and vocalists from Ozzy to David Coverdale to Jeff Tate. Where does Kevin fit in?
You know, what's really interesting about Kevin is that I got to play with him in three bands. I got to play with him in the Choir Riot, Randy Rose Choir Riot. I got to play with him in Dubrow. Mm-hmm. And I got to play with him in the Mental Health version of Choir Riot. And as I recall, you know, Kevin's mission with the Randy Rose version of Choir Riot was to showcase Randy. He was always putting the spotlight on Randy. And it was about their relationship, you know. Like, for example, Kevin wrote one of my favorite songs, Slick Black Cadillac, as a challenge from Randy. Like, to challenge him to write a really good song. Oh. So he came back and wrote the song, and I'm going like, oh my God, this one, you know. I mean, it was written before I joined the band.
Right.
But once he told me the story, I said, okay, if this guy's put on, you know, back against the wall, he's going to come up. You know, with the goods. Then the Dubrow version, after Randy went over to join Ozzy, that's when I think Kevin started going on the path of finding who we know as Kevin today from the Mental Health version of Quiet Riot, because it was really a departure from the pop rock that, I mean, when towards the end, we were really pop rock. You know, I mean, there was certain songs that were like, you know, it could have been the Archies or, you know, the Partridge Family. You know, that melodic, poppy stuff, you know.
Not even as hard edge as Sugar Sugar.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, we had a disco song, you know, One in a Million. Come on, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, it was pretty desperate. But, you know, once you put Dubrow, I think he felt that the pressure was off and he was kind of like more getting deeper into what he wanted to be as a singer, you know. And then when he got together with Frankie brought in, you know, for the Mental Health version of Quiet Riot, he brought in that more of that, you know, heaviness that the band really didn't have back then. You know, a lot of it had to do with a sign of the times, and I don't mean to use that as a, it was, you know, it was a 70s version of the band. Things were getting a little bit harder. New wave and punk were making the transition. There was a new wave of metal coming in from England, bands like Motorhead or even Ozzy, that. Yeah, so it's the right time to start getting a little bit heavier, kind of like, you know, Led Zeppelin meets AC/DC.
Right.
You know, and that's when Kevin finally made the transition to what he's known as today. You know?
Yeah, and Rudy, it's really, really spot on. If you look at the Choir Riot movie, you can actually, everything Rudy just said, you can actually see happen, because there's material in there and footage in there of the Randy era Choir Riot with Rudy in the band and Kevin, and you can clearly see that the emphasis was on Randy, and that was truly intentional. And I agree with him about Slick Black Cadillac, so much so that Kevin didn't want to record that again, and I essentially forced him to do it on the Mental Health record, because I thought it was such a great song. But if you see in the documentary, you'll see the transition from the Randy era Choir Riot to the Dubrow era Choir Riot when I first met Kevin, and there's documentation of that in the movie, and then the natural transition when Rudy rejoins the band again and we do the Mental Health record, and then, you know, it's all there for the history book. So it is all documented in the film, which is one of the things I really enjoy. That's a part of the film I really enjoy watching, because I see things that had nothing to do with me, but how that evolved to when I became part of the picture. And it's great. You know, Randy's brother and sister are in the film, and they're interviewed in the film. So they bring that perspective as well. And it's all in the movie. It's great.
It's great history behind that. And also, too, talking about Randy, and I know he didn't want to be or wasn't involved with the film Carlos Cavazo, but to replace Randy Rhoads, I think people forget. He must have, he is a hell of a player, but to get that gig where you're replacing Randy Rhoads in Quiet Riot, must have been a lot of pressure on him.
Well, you know, the thing is, you don't replace somebody like Randy Rhoads. Right. That's number one. But number two, there was a period of time where Randy had already become established with Ozzy before the Dubrow band, which then became Quiet Riot. So there was a gap in there.
It was a transition.
Yeah, and I remember that when we were doing some gigs as Dubrow, and we had a variety of guitar players, and the last person was involved, I you know, was a really, really good player, but he had never played with other musicians, and there were some time issues, and that just drives me crazy. And I said to Kevin, you know, if this guy's playing the next show, he better bring a drummer with him, because I'm not doing it. And he goes, fine, you find a guitar player. And I had seen Carlos play in this other band, Snow. And I told Kevin about him, you know, and said, hey, you know, guy looks great. He has long blonde hair, plays a Gibson Destroyer, you know.
Because that matters at the time.
Yeah, right? it mattered at the time. Yeah. Didn't wear a shirt, you know, and I'm saying, you know, we should get this guy because I spoke with his manager and the band broke up. And so I give Kevin the information. Kevin calls him. Carlos shows up. He had cut his hair completely short, about as short as yours. It was no longer blonde. It was a natural color, brown. And he had gotten rid of the Destroyer. Oh, and was wearing a shirt.
Yeah. For the extra stick.
Yeah, it came as a huge surprise. Showed up at Kevin's apartment, which Rudy also shared, with a cardboard box and all his belongings. Yeah. Yes, and so it began.
There it was. Yeah. Let's talk about when Mental Health was number one, and you guys are pretty much one of the biggest rock and roll bands in America. Tell us about some of the tours that you had. Is it good times? You guys were on top.
Yeah, you know, it's and Rudy will attest to this. When we first went out, we went out in a couple of station wagons, and then we graduated to a Winnebago. And we used to park the Winnebago in between the other band's tour buses because it was embarrassing. So when we got out of the Winnebago, it actually looked like we got out of somebody's, you know, really nice tour bus. It was a struggle. You know, we were playing a lot of the bands that we were opening up for, the major acts, would only work X amount of days a week, and we weren't getting that much money, so we would have to take club dates in between just to be able to pay the expenses.
Stay in the road, yeah.
Yeah. But it was phenomenal. It was wonderful because it really served all the bands we worked with, and it served Quiet Riot, because what happened is when we opened up for Scorpions, they had a predominantly male crowd, but Quiet Riot had a predominantly female crowd. So what it did is it exposed Scorpions to the female crowd, and it exposed Quiet Riot to the male crowd. And the same thing happened with Black Sabbath, and the same happened with ZZ Top and Iron Maiden. We were blessed to be in the position to have a record that was doing so well, yet we were still an opening act. It was beneficial for everyone. No regrets.
But then you did your own headline. I saw you guys play in Winnebago with Kickaxe, Whitesnake, and Quiet Riot on top.
Oh, yeah.
1984. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you guys were at your peak, though, I remember, because being a fan at that time, I think maybe it was 12 or 13, sometimes Kevin would say crazy things in like Circus Magazine or something. I remember was it Larry the Cat? I could put my Larry the Cat on a keyboard and he would make better sounds than some of these bands.
Well, you know, Larry was incredibly talented. So
more talented than Tori Rudy's dog?
No.
Of course not.
No. No. But, well, the difference is Tori has a business mind, whereas Larry was all about the chicks.
All about the hookers and blow. What would happen when you would see these things in the press? Would you read this stuff and go, oh, or would you just not care? Or how'd you feel about that when you saw Kevin's?
We were powerless to stop it. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that during that period of time when the band became big, the focus is almost always first and foremost on the singer, mm-hmm. and secondly on the guitar player. And everybody else is secondary. So what would happen is, you know, Kevin would get all the A interviews. And sometimes he and Carlos would do some of those interviews, and Rudy and I would get more, you know, the B and C interviews. So what happened is Kevin was speaking to a much greater forum, and completely and totally out of control. A lot of it was his angst because it took him, in his mind, so long to make it. But there was no filter with Kevin. You know, I always say that Kevin was the most honest person I've ever known about his feelings. That's not necessarily a good thing in the public eye. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know when to, you know, there's a difference between speaking with friends and speaking to the world.
Right.
and he was speaking to the world, and they took notice. And but we were powerless to stop it. We it's like a runaway train. You just sat there and hope that, that the train doesn't crash, but if it does, that you don't get hurt too badly.
How long were you guys headlining for?
We were headlining for 84 and into 85. Mm-hmm. But the problem was twofold. By then, the damage was already done. The damage to the band was already done by the time we started headlining.
Because of what Kevin was saying?
Correct. Yeah. And we were also getting a fair amount of criticism for doing another Slade song, Mama, We're All Crazy Now, on the second record. So that played into it. And we were also advised that if we're going to go out and headline, you know, we have to compete with the big boys. We have to compete with the Van Halens and all of that. And so a touring set and staging and lighting was created that it was almost impossible to support. And that with you know, sales not as strong. And when I say sales not as strong, you know, people look back and they say, well, the Condition Critical record was an absolute failure because it only sold 2 million plus yeah. units. So, you know.
Wish for one of those failures
yeah.
nowadays.
Yeah.
Right?
So anybody out there that can have one of those failures, I am so incredibly proud of you. But, you know, all of those things were had a hand against the band. And by that point, Kevin's situation was really out of control.
Did you see that, Rudy, on the road? See kind of Kevin breaking down? And
well, by then I was married. I stopped drinking for that whole tour, you know, because, you know, sometimes when you're on the road and, you know, you have to be disciplined, mm-hmm. you know, to deliver the same thing every single night. So my way of being disciplined is to really be disciplined, you know, watch what I eat, exercise, no alcohol, you know, and stuff like that. So I had a whole different lifestyle than, because I was the only married guy in the band.
Gotcha.
You know, so, you know, and sometimes when you have that in the bus, you know, it's not the best, you know, recipe.
Environment to be
yeah.
in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the dynamics. Yeah, exactly. Especially then, I think 30 years later, we can look at it and respect each other's different lifestyles, whatever those may be, and just take everybody for who they are and what mm-hmm. they do, you know. But mm-hmm. back then, you know, we weren't as mature as we are today. It took us, you know, 30 years.
It's still a work in progress.
I mentioned this to you before. There's a lot of similarities between Quiet Riot being the West Coast and Twisted Sister being the East Coast yeah. of almost the same thing happening at the same mm-hmm. time. Years and years and years of cutting your teeth and becoming really big in your area and then getting huge nationally mm. and then going away very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, you can yeah. see those parallels.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it was great to have Dee Snider from Twisted Sister
film, right?
in the film because he will give people who are watching the movie, he will give them an insight to that. You know, his whole situation with Twisted Sister, the comparisons with Quiet Riot, and he brought a lot to the table. I think when people watch the movie and see, you know, his participation in it, it reveals a lot of things that a lot of people didn't know, mm-hmm. and it gives a different perspective. You know, not just the Quiet Riot perspective, but the perspective of the time,
yeah,
of the music, and you know, the differences and the similarities between the two bands.
Yeah, how you can get so big and then have it kind of go away. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was great. He was great to have in the
really
film.
Really good yeah. in the movie. There's something else that's kind of alluded to in the movie too, and it's the classic story of the young rock guys. Kind of signing a bad contract. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that with all the records you sold with Metal Health that you really didn't come away with too much of it financially.
Yeah, you know, how I look at the situation is, you know, we it was the deal that was presented. And
you don't know any better, of course.
And you accept it and you hope for the best.
Was the deal all the publishing to the producers or?
Watch the movie.
Yeah, well, but you never really say in there. It just kind of says you ended up with
watch the movie.
All right.
Watch the movie.
Yeah, another really poignant scene is when you talk about Rudy had gone at this point in time, but when you had to get rid of Kevin in 87. How hard was that to have to get a new singer into Quiet Riot when basically Quiet Riot was based around Kevin Dubrow in so many ways?
It was more difficult. Believe me, it's been really difficult, but it was more difficult for me emotionally because even though the decision to fire Kevin in 87 was not a decision that was made by one singular person, it was made by everyone. Kevin always held me responsible for it. Mm. So that was an emotional aspect of it. The idea of getting somebody other than Kevin in the band was unthinkable to me. It was 3 years before I even considered it. 3 years. Mm-hmm. It was not an easy decision. And when you watch the film, you could see how difficult it was
for you to do that,
and how difficult it was to continue. Mm-hmm. And with all the different dynamics and everything that has happened.
What was the reason for your exit after the Condition Critical record?
Oh, conflict, personality conflicts. I mean, you know, like, again, like I just mentioned about, you know, maturity 30 years later. And, you know, I mean, I've learned how to deal with certain situations that I didn't have the right tools, how to deal with them back then. And through life, I've learned about a lot of things, you know, how to deal with them. Back then, you know, it was the way that the industry was shaped back in the 80s, up until the whole industry started shrinking and now everything is in the hands of the artists, you know. Management was not your best counselor, you know, not only to myself but to the whole group. You know, record companies were not. I mean, actually, they're not really there to babysit a band anyways, you know. But neither is management, but it's in the best interest of management to keep the group together and to keep them going in the right direction, you know, and to put out all the fires. And, you know, we had decent, good to decent management. But when it came to getting everybody in a room and saying, listen, we have a situation, what can we do to fix it? I was never approached with that, you know. So, but right now I'm in a spot that I actually don't really need that, because if I need to be in a situation that I need to fix something, now I have the tools to fix it with that I didn't have back
at
then.
The time. Yeah. Did you leave Ozzy's band to join Quiet Riot?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I went from one of the biggest bands in the world to the biggest question mark ever in the music history.
Was that because of Randy's passing?
It was definitely, I wouldn't say a byproduct, but what happened was, in order for me personally to survive what it was like to get up on stage within 10 days after Randy's death and continue the tour, I was not aware of this, but I was shut down emotionally and disconnect myself from everything that was going on in that little square that I was standing in. Yeah. I wouldn't look at the audience. I wouldn't even look at the guys in the band. All I knew was that this is the set list. 1, 2, 3, 4, play the songs. I was just playing notes. Mm. I wasn't playing music anymore. And what happened was we did a video called Speak of the Devil, which is the, you know, with Brad Gillis performing
Black Sabbath.
No, actually, there's two Speak of the Devils. There's the video that went on MTV on Halloween 1983, which is out.
Of the Diary of a Madman tour.
And I watched myself playing, and I'm going, oh, my God, I'm completely disconnected. Mm. This is not the reason why I started playing music. I needed to bring the joy of playing music again into my life. So I get while this is going on, I get a phone call from Kevin and say, hey, We're recording Thunderbird, which is a song that he wrote for Randy when he left Quiet Riot, and I used to play that song with him in Dubrow. So he invited me to come down to do it as a tribute to Randy. And of course, you know, Frankie was in the band. I have been playing with him since 1972, so it's like family, you know, like, yeah. He doesn't get any more comfortable than that. And then this guy, Carlos Cavazo, on guitar, we just met, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm going, wow, this feels good again.
Mm-hmm.
So I waited, you know, my option is I'm going, you know, I can continue doing this and be completely, you know, in one of the biggest bands in the world, but really incredibly, you know, unhappy with what I'm doing, because, you know, every time you step on stage, you know, there every you know, the first thing you heard when you during a Diary of a Madman tour was Randy actually playing Diary of a Madman, you know, the
they would intro with the opening intro with that,
and then, you know, it's the same castle, the same dwarf running around, you know, yeah, throwing meat at the audience and and wearing the same clothes and everything. It was like, oh my god, you know. So this gave me an opportunity to start again and really do what you what I originally intended to be as a musician, find the joy in playing again.
Now, yeah, kind of as a parallel thing, you know, you mentioned, or we mentioned earlier about how you went to Kevin's mom to get permission to continue Quiet Riot after Kevin passed away. Did you feel the same way that, that Rudy just described when you heard that Kevin passed away?
Well, the situation is different, and it's really interesting because I was so grateful that Rudy made the decision to leave Ozzy and come back to Quiet Riot. But at the same time, as grateful as I was, I couldn't understand, you know, I mean, Rudy and I had been through the bar circuit back east and all of that and struggling in L.A. And all of a sudden, you know, he was in one of the biggest bands of all time and he leaves it to come back to Quiet Riot.
The question mark.
So I was ridiculously grateful. I mean, thrilled. Thrilled, but I didn't understand it. Well, I just didn't understand it, mm-hmm, you know, but I wasn't going to question it because, I mean, it was a gift.
Yeah.
It took me 30 years to understand where he came from because Randy died, and as Rudy said, 10 days later, he's up on that stage playing those. Everything is the same except for this wonderful component, Randy, who's not there. I had 3 years where I didn't pick up drumsticks, I didn't play, I didn't do anything. You know, I was in mourning for 3 years. I had that, for lack of a better term, advantage that Rudy didn't. Mm-hmm. He was thrown right back into the same thing, except it wasn't the same thing. As far as the situation with Kevin's mother, I will accept any criticism. Bring it on. As much as you want to criticize me, the world can criticize me if they want for doing Quiet Riot without Kevin, as long as one of those critics is not Kevin's mother. That is at the heart of it. If she had a problem with it, then I wouldn't have moved forward.
Really?
Yeah. That's the only person that I didn't want to insult or hurt or in any stretch of the imagination being considerate of. Everybody else can say what they want. Makes no difference to me. Makes no difference to me. I want their support, but if they don't offer it, then that's their business, you know? Life goes on.
What was your mindset after 3 years to finally get back on the horse? Because when Kevin died, I mean, you mentioned this a little bit, with Randy, obviously no fault of his own, horrible accident. With Kevin, you know, also an accident, but kind of a self-imposed one with an OD, mm-hmm, or whatever it was. Was there a lot of anger there towards Kevin? Because not only did you lose your best friend, but you lose your business partner and you lose your job.
You know, the dynamics of it are so intricate. It wasn't until Regina wanted to make the film that I seriously, you know, because I mean it was the back of my mind to maybe try it again, because I'm one of those people that Rudy will tell you I will always try the most impossible thing. I will always try,
you know, that's how you make it,
to see if I can overcome it. Right. And if I don't, you don't. But it wasn't until, you know, I was really forced to look at all this footage that I had. And all the pictures and all the magazines. Because remember, it's not just live performances, home movies, you know, pictures of us backstage, stuff that nobody saw but the people that were, you know, in our little party. That I came to realize that you know, I miss Kevin, but I miss being in Quiet Riot because I've invested almost my entire adult career in this band.
Sure.
And I felt it was unfair. For me not to be able to continue, you know, even though a critical component was now, you know, not part of the picture.
And how hard was it to play that first gig? You show how you found Mark Huff, who's not no longer in the band, but how hard was it to play that first gig without Kevin Dubrow as the front man?
The easiest way to explain that is that I was always comfortable sitting back there on the drums and watching Kevin go crazy on stage, mm-hmm, for all those years. Mm-hmm. And that was gone. That was gone. Yeah.
Quick question. I was going to bring this up earlier. Do you think speaking about the 80s, and it was so much about look, you know, hair and all that stuff. And then Kevin on Quiet Riot 3 has like this, I guess you'd say a wig, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the wig.
Extensions.
Extensions,
yes,
okay.
Extensions.
It looked, so it wasn't even, it was just like he has his hair. And then it's not like now where you could just shave it.
Or right.
Really, you had to have long hair.
Louis the 14th.
Exactly.
Yes.
Was that his decision? Like, was he really like, I got to have long hair? Was it something he just wanted to try? Because he had it for the rest of his career. He had blonde extensions. He had black curly extensions, everything like that.
He was very image motivated. Mm. He also got bored with things, you know, very quickly because his mind was always racing. So when you see all the different, you know, changes over time with Kevin, a lot of it had to do with, yeah, he was image conscious, but he also got bored very easily. And you know, a lot of the stuff was tributes to some of his heroes. You know, I mean, the last look that Kevin had, both, you know, both the hair and the clothes were classic 1972 Rod Stewart in the Faces.
I was going to say, yeah, it was like a blonde, straight.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And he made no apologies for it. He didn't care whether people knew it or didn't know it. He didn't care. You know, he only cared about what he cared about.
Yeah,
he was lucky in that regard. You know, it does. Caused a lot of problems. It leaves a lot of wreckage.
Sure, it caused a lot of problems back in those days too, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Rudy, just as we wind down here, what's one of your favorite memories about Quiet Riot? Is there one that stands out in your mind?
Yeah, there's really so many. Well, Us Festival, really. I mean, because it's not just what happened on stage, it's what happened before and after. Mostly before, what led to us playing, you know, at the Ausfest. So what happened during, you know, for example, Frankie mentioned before, we already had gigs like that when we were offered that show within a couple of days before the actual Us Festival, mm-hmm. right? So we had to like make some arrangements and send our own road crew ahead. Mm. They didn't come to the Us Festival.
Oh.
Who came to our festival? Us Festival was actually our manager and our tour manager.
Yeah, and we took one of our crew, Carlos's guitar tech.
Yes. So, but the guy that was taking care of my stuff was our tour manager, who never even had his hand on a guitar tuner. And back in the, you know, we had this weird guitar tuner that you could dial in whatever sounded, you know, the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like calibrated, you know, like we have nowadays. So I calibrated and I give it to the guy and I said, okay, just put this on stage and I'll tune my guitar during the guitar solo. So he goes, okay, no problem. And it was one of those things that we were in the trailer, and every time somebody came back from the stage, they would be petrified. It would be like, oh my God, there's so many people out there. It's, oh my God, I'm so scared. I'm really, you're scared. You're going to be behind the amps. Nobody's going to see you. I don't want to know how scared you are because, you know, I have to deal with this, right?
Yeah.
So we get up on stage and we do our set, and it was like, you know, it was hot, or, you know, everything was going out of tune.
Yeah,
so here comes Carlos's guitar solo, and I go behind the stack that actually I rented some gear that didn't work at all. My back line was not working. That big thing you see behind me was
just for show.
It was called Diamond Sound, but it was really actually cubic zirconia sound. Okay.
Yeah, it was supposed to work, but it didn't. Yeah. Right. So actually, thank God that the company that was running the monitors was Tasco, who were all the company that did the Aussie tour, and I knew all the guys, so they actually run me through the monitor system.
Wow.
All the we had like huge, mm-hmm. you know, side
PA everywhere,
you know,
PA side
everywhere.
Fills, yeah.
So that's how I played. So here comes the guitar solo. I go back there to tune my guitar, and my tuner was off calibration completely. And I'm going, what am I going to do now? I say, well, okay, well, I think it was around here. You know, I take the dial, kind of like eye it in. It's around here. So I'm tuned, right? So I go, okay, I'm tuned. So we go back for the next two songs, you know, Mental Health and Common Feel the Noise, and you'll hear it in the video. I'm completely out of tune.
Yeah, that's not feedback you hear. That's dogs howling.
Because I'm in tune to myself, but not to Carlos.
Not to the band.
So that's my memory of the Oscars.
Let me add to that. I needed to have a drum tech because our drum tech wasn't going to be there. So I had our tour manager get in touch with a drum tech that I had before that we had fired,
mm-hmm.
and hired him so I'd have somebody there. So here we are. It's about 40 minutes before we were supposed to go on, and I'm standing backstage, and my drum kit is not quite completely set up yet, and you know, it was getting down to the wire. So I go out there, and my tech is like on one knee, clutching his heart. And he goes, I think I'm having a heart attack, you know, a drug-induced heart attack, no less, right? I think I'm having a heart attack. Now, I think he's messing with me, right? So he's now down laying on the stage, and I start to kick him, right? And as I'm kicking, the paramedics come around the corner with a... And they take him away. So now he's gone. My drum set's not set up, right? So I go backstage. I tie my hair back up in a ponytail. I put a T-shirt on, you know, some roadie sweaty T-shirt on, and put a baseball cap on and sunglasses. I'm setting up my drums, pretending I'm not me.
Right.
Okay. I still have the black and red tights, but I'm pretending I'm not me. That was the US Festival. That was the real US Festival.
That's the true story of rock and roll. The biggest gig of your career. And you got to set up your own stuff.
And I'm kicking this poor guy because I think he's messing with you, right?
What was it like backstage? Did you guys stick around after the show, or did you have to go right away? No. You had to leave right away.
We had to leave right away. Yeah,
down to the next gig.
Yeah.
So people always think you guys are hanging around after. Did you see any of the bands? It's like, no, we got a job to do.
Oh yeah. Champagne? No. Caviar? No. Limo? No.
One thing that I recall as we were getting in the van, we were one of the everybody else was going by helicopter. We had a van that had to go through traffic, you know, to get to the gig, right? Van Halen was arriving from the night before from partying, so it was like what, 11 or 10:30, 11 o'clock?
10:30 in the morning, yeah.
They were arriving back to the hotel.
Still getting back. Yeah.
And let me tell you, to give you an idea how much discipline I had, even at my most undisciplined, is when we checked into the hotel the night before for to play the US Festival, I'm walking down the hallway and I run into Alex Van Halen and Greg's drum tech, who insisted that I go drinking with him. And of course, you throw the gauntlet down, I'm going to go. But at some point, I knew that I had to stop this, and they did not want to let me go. So I pulled the old, I got to go to the bathroom, and then I went over to the bathroom. There was no one in the bathroom, right? And I said, oh, somebody's in the bathroom, so I'm going to go to my room, go to the bathroom. And that was it.
Yeah.
I skipped.
You split.
They didn't. They continued.
Well, that was kind of the 80s, wasn't it?
To some.
The excellent documentary is called Well, Now You're Here. There's No Way Back. It's on iTunes. It's on DVD. It's on Showtime still. You got to check it out. It's an amazing story. And the thing I love is two friends for almost 50 years, 40 years, over 40 years.
Yeah.
My goodness, man. That's very, very cool. A Quiet Riot still continuing on with Jizzy Pearl now, who I think is a great singer.
Yeah. It's worked out really well with Jizzy.
He's a true pro too.
Yeah. He's been around a long time. He's done it. He gets it. He's not expecting to walk into a situation and all of a sudden, and especially with the economy and the industry, the way it is, he gets it. And that's been a breath of fresh air.
And Rudy, you're still playing with every band ever.
Yeah, well, you know what? As a matter of fact, Frankie, there's the Quiet Riot Bang Your Head tour.
That's right.
When it starts in June.
They just sent out a blast.
So it's actually you guys are putting on kind of like a touring.
Yeah, we did it last. Thing. We did it last year. It was the Bang Your Head tour 2014, and that was with Faster Pussycat. Bullet Boys and Gilby Clark. From Guns N' Roses. And this year's edition is Quiet Riot, Jack Russell's Great White, Tracy Guns, LA Guns, and Enough's Enough. And so they just started, they're just beginning to book that tour now. The blast went out this morning.
Yeah. How does that fit in?
And I'm going to be there.
You're going to be there?
In a different band.
You got to come on stage and jam, though, man, at some point.
Well, it gives us an excuse to go and get coffee.
Oh, listen, I'm ridiculously grateful for that because I'm going to be spending almost all my time with Rudy. It's that comfortable.
Yeah, we always like saying, so when do you have time to go and get some coffee? And I go, so, you know, this time is like, okay, we're in the same city, same time. Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, so we'll be back, you know, just really totally coffee buzzed out.
Guys, thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks to Rudy Sarzo and Frankie Benali from Quiet Riot. The documentary, once again, it's called Well, Now You're Here, There's No Way Back. It's running on Showtime earlier this year, and now it's available on iTunes, Google Play, video on demand starting August 18th. And here's the best part. When it's released August 18th, there's going to be nearly an hour of extra bonus features and material. QuietRiotMovie.com will have all the updates. Keep checking the site. You'll hear more information here, right here on
on this show. And remember, if you live in LA, you can see the documentary on the big screen playing at the Arena Theater in Hollywood starting May 22nd. That's next Friday, okay? May 22nd at the Arena Theater in Hollywood. Go check it out. If you need some transportation there, you might want to get a new car. You can do that through True Car app, or you can visit truecar.com. It'll save you tons of time and tons of money. Listen, don't waste valuable weekend time going from dealership to dealership in search of the perfect car for you. Why waste hours searching? You can check out True Car and the True Car mobile app in mere minutes. You can build the car you actually want. You can find out what other people paid for it. It's so easy to fall in love with your new car. You can also lock in the guaranteed savings, usually over $3,000 off MSRP. What a bargain for you. We got a lot of ways to spend the weekends. You want to spend that time with your loved ones, friends, families, doing fun activities. Don't give up that free time to hunt for the car. Let True Car and True Car mobile app do all the hard work for you, okay? I know you need the car. I want to help you get it. Steal your weekends back and get the car you want without overpaying. Save time, save money, and never overpay, all right? Get the good, reliable transportation you need and get it quicker than ever. Download the True Car app today, all right? And speaking of that car, you might want to go to see Fozzie. We got a bunch of shows this summer, including the dates with Slash, the huge shows with Slash. Those start next week, May 18th, Chicago, 21st, Austin, 22nd at the Jefferson Theater in Beaumont, Texas. That's just Fozzie. 23rd, Houston, 24th, Dallas. So many cool shows. Go to FozzieRock.com to hear about all of them. VIP information and information about the June 25th show in Des Moines, June 26th, Sioux City, July 24th in Kitchener, Ontario, August 9th, Heavy Montreal, Montreal, Kiss Cruise, October 30th, Paul and Gene and all my buddies in Kiss. That's sold out, but I can still brag about it. So many cool things coming up. I want you to go to FozzieRock.com once again. Check all that stuff out. I got a huge summer, so many projects to talk about. Ones that you know about, ones that you don't know about. Stick with me, man. You know I love you. I'm looking forward to seeing you. I'm looking forward to having a lot more great shows here. And I thank you for shopping online through my Amazon links. It's the easiest way to support the show, so I can keep doing it for free for twice a week. Find those Amazon links at podcastone.com. Support our shows banner at the top of the page. Then click on Talk is Jericho. You see all three of my Amazon links in the UK, the USA, the Canada. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to this show, so we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. No extra fees or hidden challenges. You're just getting your shopping done. You help me out in the process. That's it. Another amazing show with awesome, awesome, awesome Frankie Benali and Rudy Sarzo. Of course, Ash the Fish Expert. I love him so much. I will see you guys next week. I got a surprise for you. All right. I told you July 4th who my opponent was in Tokyo at the Sumo Arena. Well, he's also going to be my opponent this Wednesday on Talk is Jericho. That's right. I got NXT's Finn Balor on the show. That's going to be huge. The debut podcast of Finn Balor, at least since he's been in NXT, and he's here with me. You want to hear it? You know where to come. You stay hard. You stay hungry. You stay cool. And we'll see you next Wednesday right here on PodcastOne.com on Talk is Jericho. A big thank you and a big Y-E-A-H-B-O-Y-E-E. Yeah.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
Five seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay, judges... That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley-Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.